Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to all of our listeners. I don't know how people have been finding this podcast. Actually, if you could let us know how you found it, that would be really interesting to both of us. But we have gathered a bunch of new subscribers this week. I think at least in the hundreds, if not the thousands of new people are listening to the show this week that weren't last week. So welcome to all of you. We hope you like it here and hope you find our discussion of Game of Thrones interesting. If you've never been here before, this is your first time listening to the podcast, what we do is we talk about this show primarily as a television show. Even though Joanna's read the books, we do not reveal anything that happens in future episodes of Game of Thrones. That includes anything that appears in the next time on Game of Thrones previews that you see on HBO sometimes. If you'd like to share what you think of the podcast or of the show, you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. You can also find all of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com. And I think we got to talk about a few things. Every week we always like to sort of run through a detailed scene-by-scene recap of every single episode. This week we'll be discussing everything through Season 3, Episode 3, which is entitled Walk of Punishment. But before we do that, we always like to make corrections for the things that we got wrong last week, and then we'll get into this episode, and then we'll talk about some of your emails. We'll also thank some of the people who made this episode and this podcast possible by donating to us through Kickstarter. We might even thank them twice, like last time's unfortunate lack of editing. But let's talk about some of the errors that we made in last week's episode. So this email comes in from Julia from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And she writes in, I have a minor correction. In your latest episode, Joanna seems to imply that Kat is praying to the old gods when she's really praying to the Seven, because Kat is a southerner, so she follows the Andals gods, which are actually sometimes called new gods in the books and are, in my opinion, the major religion that seems to have no supernatural power thus far. The other one is the drowned god religion from the Iron Islands. Yes, we have some people like Davos believing that they have been saved by the Seven, but no quote-unquote magic. The old gods of the North are really not as showy as the Red God, but stuff like wargs, giants, green dreams, and the fact that they have a giant wall of ice that no one knows exactly how it was built and repels ice zombies are usually tied to old gods magic in the Westeros culture. Also, I find it really unfortunate that there's no time in the TV show to go more in-depth on these things, because the stuff about the religions and the colonization of Westeros, all the prophecies, and the huge ancient history we get from the books, you know, from the First Man and the children of the forest fighting the Andals to how the Targaryens took Westeros to smaller-scale stuff like the Tower of Joy, there's just so much stuff that TV viewers will probably never know, and that really make a difference, at least in my enjoyment of the story. But hopefully it will still be enjoyable to most people without all this knowledge. And when the Daves of the world get confused, there's always Joanna to clear things up, right?
Except for when I'm wrong.
Except for when she's wrong, which happens frequently. No, I'm just joking. I don't even remember exactly how I got this wrong last week, right? That Kat was praying to... I said she was praying... you seem to imply that she was praying to the old gods when she's praying to the Seven, right?
Right.
Which is distinct... they are... The Seven are the new gods? Is that right?
Well, I mean, there's new gods and then there's newer gods. And
right, so the new gods are theoretically also not just the Seven, but also the Red God, which is Melisandre's god, right?
Right.
Okay.
And so, yeah, the Sept or whatever, that's we saw those being burnt in Season 2. Those are Davos's gods. Remember how they were like burning all those Seven statues?
Right.
So they're older for Westeros than the Red God. But yeah, the old gods, like Ned Stark used to go into what they call the Godswood and like basically pray to the trees. And so sometimes they call them derogatorily like tree worshippers or something like that.
Right.
So that's like the way older religion. So yeah, it's...
So Kat follows the Andals gods, but Ned follows the old gods?
Correct? Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there's some inter-religion marriage going on there.
I mean, it's pretty racy stuff.
I agree.
Think about it.
Hot stuff. Okay, anything else we need to correct from last week? There was some debate on the /film.com boards. Again, you can find all of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com. And there was some debate about how spoilery we are being on this show. And so let me just say, like, I hear you guys loud and clear. Like, I am the one holding the banner on, you know, not trying to spoil people with stuff from the books. But let me, so Joanna's job is very difficult. Let's put it that way, right? Like, the point of having someone who's read the books and someone who hasn't read the books is that, theoretically, someone who's read the books can illuminate things that someone who hasn't read the books is not privy to, and can help provide context where none is provided by the show, nor will any ever be provided by the show, right? And occasionally, like, she may say something that some people interpret to be a spoiler, but I think Joanna has gotten really careful about making sure that nothing she says will ruin our enjoyment of future episodes or books. One question, Joanna, that I think was actually kind of a good one is, are we going to have a policy that no future books will be spoiled on the podcast? Because, you know,
there are some people who are like reading a book per season,
right?
You know,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, I won't spoil anything that the show doesn't spoil. You know what I mean? Like, the show might spoil your enjoyment of future books because they're plucking some plot lines. But a good point that a listener brought up that I should have brought up last week is that the books don't necessarily go in chronological order. A lot of the actions that happen in book four are happening parallel in time to what happens in book five. So it's not like when I talk about Theon and it's, you know, book five stuff, it's not 2 years from now this is what's happening to Theon. It's
right.
That we finally get it filled in. You know, so they're not – the writers aren't really messing with the timeline. It's more just – they're like, we're going to show this now rather than leave you in suspense for two seasons as to what's going on with Theon.
Right.
Does that make sense? So.
It does make sense. I mean, I do think – point taken about being careful about revealing anything that happens in future books, right? So – are we agreed on that, Joanna?
Yeah, we are. And, you know, what I asked Dave this week, actually, is don't ask me too much about Theon. Like, just don't ask me too much about Theon, then I won't be in, like, a weird point
right.
about talking about
right,
Theon.
Right,
so.
Right, right. But, I mean, my point is just that, like, you know, we should only talk about the books insofar as they assist with our understanding of what is going on screen right now.
Right. And Dave and I have a minor disagreement there, and I don't want to, like, you know, dig my heels in and spoil anyone in pursuit of this. But I also find talking about the way in which this is an adaptation to be kind of interesting.
Oh yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. I think there's people who are listeners who are on the comment boards who don't find it interesting. But I mean, we're still going to do it anyway. You know, there's people who don't find discussion of the way the show uses nudity to be interesting, but we're still going to talk about it.
Yeah, we are.
But I do think that primarily as listeners, you guys should know that, like, I am very sensitive to spoilers, incredibly sensitive to spoilers, maybe overly sensitive to spoilers. And so any chiding that you do of Joanna on public boards, I have done in private, you know, to the nth degree.
I've already cried. Dave has already made me cry.
I've made Joanna cry, no joke, about spoiling stuff. And so, you know, it's something we take seriously. So you should assume that that we will not spoil anything in future episodes of the show, nor in anything in future books from the series. And that if we do something that's like that does arguably spoil stuff, then feel free to give us a difficult time about it. But just know that we are trying to do our best in terms of balancing those things. I did enjoy someone's comment when they said, seriously, when was the last time someone started out a discussion about a potential spoiler with, I've done a lot of thinking and I think this is safe for me to say, and what was actually said was something that didn't spoil anything.
That was the only thing that guy said that made me laugh.
that was Spencer's comment at slashfilm.com, which I thought was fairly astute. Although, you know, sometimes someone can say, I'm not going to spoil this, and they don't end up spoiling it. So, but yes, point taken, people, and we will incorporate your feedback into how we handle the show. But it is primarily a discussion of the TV show as a TV show, and we'll refrain from any future discussion. Okay. Anything else you want to say on that, Joanna, or are we good?
No, we're good.
One other announcement I want to make before we actually delve into this week's episode, which is that a lot of people have been having trouble with the iOS podcast app that is not a great app by many measures, and they've apparently been having difficulty downloading our episodes to the iOS podcast app, to which I would say do not use that app. In virtually any other way you can access the show is superior to that app. online, download it. You know, if you don't want to get away from your smartphone, so the Stitcher app is appropriate, as well as the Downcast app. There are good ways to listen to Game of Thrones podcast, A Cast of Kings. So you can
We're not officially endorsing them. They're not paying us to endorse them.
Correct.
But I personally, I had trouble myself, and so I switched to Stitcher, and I've been happy with it. So.
I am definitely not officially endorsing any of those.
Right.
But I will say that in a pinch, if you must listen to the podcast, and let's be honest, of course, there are many people out there who need to scratch that Joanna and Dave itch, then those apps are a good way to do it. So the Stitcher app and the Downcast app are but many of the ways you can listen to the podcast without using the iOS podcast apps.
Yeah, and we apologize. There's nothing we can do on our end to fix the other problem.
Correct.
So we apologize for the inconvenience.
Apologies for the inconvenience. I will also say that if you actually delete the iOS podcast app, in that situation, you can't access it at all. But I'd actually recommend you delete the iOS podcast app because it's not very good. So that is all. Anyway, let's move on into the actual episode, Joanna. So this episode is entitled A Walk of Punishment. And it begins at Riverrun. This is the first time we've been in Riverrun. So it's also the first time we've seen Riverrun in the opening credits.
Right. I loved it. I loved the little Riverrun set that they showed in the opening credits.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I was paying attention, guys. I saw it.
And we see it's Kat's father who I believe is having his funeral, right?
Right, Lord Hoster Tully.
So what the hell was going on in this scene? That there's this kind of ceremony where they have to fire an arrow and light the dude on fire. And it's kind of played for laughs. It's kind of like, wah, wah, this guy who you don't know is botching it. And then so this other guy who you also
you don't know
fixes it.
Right.
So
I think they were trying to silently introduce these characters, and I thought they did a really good job sketching out the characterization. So you have Edmure Tully, who's the first archer, and that's Kat's brother. And he's the heir to Riverrun. So now that Lord Hoster Tully is dead, Edmure's going to be inheriting Riverrun. And yeah, it's like a Viking funeral where they put the deceased in a boat and shoot a flaming arrow to burn the body. And Edmure botches it over and over again. And I just thought his facial expressions were priceless. And then Brynden Tully, who's called the Blackfish, and he's Kat's uncle, so the deceased brother, just comes over and takes over and does it. And right. I don't know, the tone was weird for a funeral, but it cracked me up and I loved it. I thought it was a great introduction of the characters.
Yeah, and I love how, was it Edmure? No, Edmure was the guy that messed it up, right?
Right.
But the Blackfish, he didn't even need to look. He just fired it and just kind of walked away. He's like a dude walking away from an explosion.
Exactly.
In a movie.
And that's perfect. He's a badass guy. He's in the earlier books as like a really strong warrior, and we hadn't seen him yet in the show. And I thought they did a good job.
Yeah. So then we have this conversation with Edmure, the Blackfish, Kat, and Rob. And Rob kind of chastising Edmure for totally messing up his strategy, right?
Your instructions were to wait for him to come to you.
I seized an opportunity.
What value was the mill?
The mountain was garrisoned across the river from it.
Is he there now?
Of course not. We took the fight to him. He could not withstand us.
I wanted to draw the mountain into the west, into our country where we could surround him and kill him. I wanted him to chase us, which he would have done because he is a mad dog without a strategic thought in his head. I could have that head on a spike by now.
Yeah, I don't think Kat was in that scene, but it's the three guys are talking, and what I thought that scene really showed was what a good strategist Rob is. And he may be young, but there's a reason he's been winning all his battles, and it's because he's got a knack for war strategy, which is not something that we know he's been winning, but I think a lot of it has been attributed to his direwolf or something like that, you know, and I don't think that his ability as a leader and as a warrior has really shone through as much as it does in this scene.
Right, right. So yeah, apologies for the cat reference, but that is sort of part of the whole section at Riverrun is what
I was
thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we get to see Rob dressing down Edmure, the guy who botched the arrow thing. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's good. Edmure is apparently incompetent in many ways. So that was fun to see. And obviously very humiliating because Rob is much younger and
right, and he's his nephew. Like, this is his young nephew, and he's, you know, Brandon sort of chastised him and is like, he's your king. Don't call him Rob. He is your king. You know, treat him with respect. So, yeah.
So then later on in the episode at River Run, we get this nice scene between Kat and Brandon, correct?
Right? Yes, yes.
Where they were talking about sitting by the window, and Kat is terrified that Brandon and Rickon are dead.
Right.
And there's this very moving scene in which she kind of talks about waiting at the window for her father to come back, and now, like, she has become what she not necessarily despised, but what has kind of haunted her as a youth, right?
Right, right.
So what did you make of the scene, Joanna? Because you were unimpressed with Kat's monologue last week.
Oh, well, I think, you know, I think they're trying, like I said last week, I think they're trying really hard to make her a more sympathetic character, you know? And I think that was needed, because I think, I don't know if it was Michelle Fairley's performance or the character of Kat herself, but I don't think she was a very popular character. And so I think they're trying to sort of,
like, you don't think she's a popular character in the context of the show, right? Like, meaning that people don't like her.
Right.
Because she kind of is, she has deprived people of their vengeance of Jamie, basically.
Well, and she, no, I don't mean just in the context of the show. I mean, yeah, the Rob's soldiers don't like her, but I think viewers aren't really feeling any squishy feeling towards Kat, you know?
Well, why do you think that is, Joanna? Serious question.
I don't know. You know, I think she's a very well, she hates Jon Snow, which is hard for us because, you know, in theory, we're supposed to like Jon Snow. She's a very hard woman. Like, she's not a soft woman, but she's not a villain. She's not like someone you love to hate, like Cersei. Like, she's supposed to be the hero, but she's a very severe woman. And so I think it's good that we're seeing this sort of softer, motherly side to her. Not like a woman can't be strong and she has to be soft or whatever, but I don't know, just the combination for me wasn't working very well, and I think they're trying to make you feel better. I mean, are you a huge fan of Kat? Have you been?
Yeah, I actually am. I mean, we see this dynamic repeat over and over again, because I don't remember where I read this article, if it was at Pajiba or at Warming Glow or something like that, but someone essentially wrote the article about why people hate women in popular TV series. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, like the nagging wife trope.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And that trope is she hasn't really been the nagging wife for a while, because obviously she hasn't been a wife for a while. But
the Skylar White.
Yeah, she is not. She kind of has echoes of a Skylar White equivalent. Skylar White from Breaking Bad. That one character drives action forward, and another character tries to impede action. Which one do you think the audience is going to relate to more? Right. And Ned's like, got to do this thing, got to do this thing. And Kat's like, no, you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it for this reason. You shouldn't do it for this reason. And so on and so forth. Right.
So, yeah, I didn't think of her. I didn't think of her in that context. That's interesting.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think it's really been like that for her in the last season, you know, in the last 10 episodes or so.
Mm-hmm.
But, I, you know, I can see why that would rub people the wrong way to begin with, and makes a bad impression. I think she's totally just doing what she thinks needs to be done. And I think.
Right. But I mean, in taking Tyrion hostage in the first place, that was a huge sort of diplomacy blunder, and then letting him go, you know? And
I don't think the consequences of that are really depicted that well on the show. Like, when I think of what started this war, I think of Joffrey beheading Ned. I don't really think...
The reason that Ned was taken prisoner was because Tyrion was captured.
I mean, indirectly, right?
No, I mean, that's what started the huge problem between the Starks and the Lannisters. Well, no. Bran being pushed out the window is what started.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like I don't think that it's attributable to this one action that she did, because she was doing what she thought was right.
Right, but I'm saying what she thought was right was wrong.
Well, she that's true, first of all. By the way, was it ever resolved how Tyrion's blade got into Bran's bedroom?
Not yet.
Okay. So she thought that it was Tyrion's responsibility. And she had circumstantial evidence, right?
Right, but it was not strategically smart while your family is in the lion's den, surrounded by Lannisters, to capture one of them. Like, if Ned and her daughters hadn't been at King's Landing, it would have been you know, a thing to do. But her family is in peril because she took Tyrion that way.
I mean,
that's why Jaime comes and surrounds Ned in season one and like kills all of his men because Tyrion's been captured.
Right. No, that, I remember that part. But it, yeah, again, to blame it on her, you know, you could blame it on so many other people.
You could.
In this chain.
Sure.
So.
And then also letting Jaime Lannister go. I mean, she's doing what she thinks she needs to do. But strategically, like, that was a dicey move. So I'm not saying I don't think of Kat the same way I think of Skylar White. I mean, well, I quite like Skylar White on Breaking Bad, but yeah, that whole trope, like, I've never thought of her in that way. But I do feel like she has made some errors in judgment that I understand why, because it's all for her family. Like, she's trying to be to defend and protect her family. But I think the unfortunate consequences of the way that she goes about it has made her an unsympathetic character, not just to the Karstarks of the world, the Freys or whatever, like to the viewer. And I think the scene that they had last week with Talisa and the scene they had this week with Brendan goes a long way into sort of making her a more sympathetic character, because you understand a bit more of her heartbreak.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I never, you know, I didn't dislike her at all to begin with. So.
Right.
It's not an issue for me.
Gotcha.
But I can see from your description why some people do dislike her. So also, as you mentioned, the scene last week was totally fabricated, right? Here's my question, Joanna, because there's a scene that Kat had with Talisa last week where she kind of tells her about making a deal with the gods about Jon Snow surviving. And you said that scene between Kat and Talisa was totally fabricated. My question is the is that conversation fabricated, or just like, or that thought, that sort of thought of Kat fabricated, like that whole incident with Jon almost dying? Was that in the books at all? Do you recall?
I believe that whole incident is fabricated, but what it communicates is definitely not fabricated, which is that she hates Jon, and it might be something that one forgets.
Don't forget her hatred is what.
Yeah, the it was early in season one that she was like, "Get the fuck out of here!" You know, you can't even say goodbye to your younger brother who's in a coma. Get out. So it's just a reminder of her hatred, and so for that, it was accurate to her character, I think. But, you know, something that we've talked about before is that the whole Talisa character is different in the show than she is in the book. And so basically pretty much any scene with Talisa is not in the books. So.
Got it.
There's a similar character, you know? So anyway, I don't want to say any more about that.
There's a scene at King's Landing this week.
Well, just really quickly, we should cover that Talisa goes and talks to the Lannister boys.
Who are adorable.
Who are adorable captives in their little tower. So
right, and she's
and that. I mean, it was a pretty cute scene where they're like, "We heard he turns into a wolf," and she's like, "Only if it's a full moon." I mean, it was a cute little scene.
So. Nice British accent there, Joanna.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
it was cute. I liked it, and but at the same time, I think Rob made a good point about how strategically useless these characters are, right?
Yeah, Martin and Willem Lannister, they're like, you know, third cousins twice removed.
Yeah, whatever, one gives a crap about them, so they're not going to be able to like hold them hostage. They're just pawns in this terrible game that these families are playing. So
right, but they're little boys, so you know, let's not anyway.
All right, don't even know what you're getting at there, but fine. So then. We cut to King's Landing, and there is a scene of the Small Council, the newly reconstituted Small Council, which now features Tywin as well as Tyrion as Master of Coin. And there's this bit with a chair that happens. So quick question. Does the chair bit happen in the book?
It does, but it's like a sentence. It's like Cersei made sure she was sitting next to Tywin, and Tyrion was sitting at the head. Like, that's all it is in the book, but it's not this whole, like, drawn-out, hilarious bit of – I thought that was great.
So they kind of all stand there, and they're trying to figure out where to sit. And, of course, Baelish is like, well, I got to sit next to the hand, obviously. And everyone's trying to take their place. And then Tyrion's just like, you know what? I'm not even going to play the same game as you guys.
Right.
I'm just going to sit at the head.
Sit
at the head, right, and make a big show of it by dragging this chair, which makes that horrible noise. So that was funny. And then they have a conversation about what they update each other on, what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about Jaime, they talk about Harrenhal, which we obviously saw last week and was promised to Lord Baelish at the end of season two. So now they're talking about what is going to happen with it, right? So what do you think, Joanna, were the major developments in this scene?
That Baelish is the Lord of Harrenhal, but like sort of a name only because it's occupied by the Northerners.
And Varys gets in a dig at that.
Yes. Varys's face in the whole scene is just priceless. Like when Cersei does her stuff with a Cher, he's laughing. Like, I love that guy. That actor is so good. And then the big development is that Baelish is going to go try to court Lysa Arryn, who we haven't seen since season one, I think. But that's Kat's sister.
Is that the sister that was breastfeeding?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and she's not married. She's not, that woman's not taken.
That catch. Okay, so she was married to the Hand of the King, who dies at the beginning of season one, which is why Ned becomes Hand of the King.
Right, John Arryn.
Dies at the beginning of season one, so she's his widow. She fled back to the Eyrie, which is her home, like her home with John Arryn, to get away from King's Landing because she felt like she was in danger. And so, as we've seen, she's completely Looney Tunes cuckoo bananas. And she's reluctant to help Kat. Even though Rob is her nephew, she's not been like an ally to them at all in this war. She just wants to stay out of it. So basically, Baelish wants to go to court her over to the Lannister side by seducing her. That makes sense?
It does make sense. Good luck with that, Baelish.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be... It's going to be an uphill battle for that one, I think.
I mean, she really loves her son, so good luck getting him.
That was so messed up. And you know, thinking back on that, those sequences, like what kind of strikes me is that even though these are fictional characters, obviously an actual kid had to play that part, right? An actual child actor had to breastfeed from this woman and act like a total, you know, nutso. And I just hope that this show isn't negatively affecting our next generation. So that's all that happens at King's Landing, at least in the first part of this episode. Let's return there later on in this podcast episode. I just want to talk briefly about a couple of quick scenes that we got, right? Like, we didn't go too in-depth into the Arya storyline nor the Melisandre storyline this week.
Right.
But let's talk about those, and then let's thank some of our sponsors this week. So we got a little bit of what happens with Arya, because that was kind of up in the air at the end of last week's episode. What is going to happen with her? And it seems to me that the Brotherhood has decided to hang on. They're not going to let her go, but they're not going to treat her like a prisoner either. They just need to – she's going to hang on to her, probably for her strategic value, I'm guessing, and just see what happens, because letting her go would be stupid for anyone in that situation. And Hot Pie, the – corpulent child among them, decides to stay with the inn that they were at the end of the last episode, or at last episode, correct?
Right.
Because his bread is so good.
Mm-hmm.
How did he... I'm curious how he learned to make such good bread, but that was kind of a funny scene, kind of a touching scene, right? Where they... the last thing that Arya says to him is, oh, it's really good. You know, like, the bread is good, and he kind
of... I loved her delivery of that line. It was really sweet.
Yeah. He kind of found his place. And that whole sequence is great, where she didn't know exactly what the bread was shaped like. And he was, it was just a touching scene that these people have been through this crazy thing together, and that they're now saying goodbye. They're not like ultra close, you know what I mean? At least in the show, they're not ultra close.
Right, but they went through so much together that even if you're not good friends, having gone through that together, it's a sweet parting. It's, you know, it wasn't a violent parting of the ways as we often get, or someone's died, or they're separated by circumstances. It's just like, he's like, I'm going to bake bread at this inn now because it seems a little safer. And she's like, okay, bye. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So a parting of good companions. And I will see what happens with Arya next. What the Brotherhood has in store for her, I have no idea. I don't think they know, because they just found out that she was Arya Stark last episode. But who knows? Who knows? And we finally got a little bit of the Melisandre-Stannis relationship again this week. Melisandre is leaving. And Stannis is kind of really... He is like... really on board with her at this point. You know what I mean? Like, he at the end, like, even last season, throughout last season, you could tell Stannis kind of had this uncertainty, but now he's kind of full-on infatuation with this woman.
Right. She's got him wrapped around her finger, basically.
Right, and who wouldn't? And she's saying to him, your fire has burned low. Who knows what that means? She makes some cryptic remarks in this episode. Your fire has burned low, and she also said, there are others with your blood in their veins. I have no idea what the hell she's talking about. I assume she's saying Baratheon blood, right? But it's not clear to me.
I know. It was like a Yoda moment where she's like, there is another Skywalker.
Yeah, right.
I'm not going to illuminate that at all. I think it's meant to be cryptic. But, suffice to say, I do know what it means, but, you know.
Okay. So we'll leave it at that. It was just a quick scene. Now that I think about it, was there anyone who wasn't covered in this week's episode? I think this episode had pretty much everyone, right?
I mean, we didn't see Davos, but like if you check in with Melisandre and Stannis, you can just assume that Davos is like rotting in the prison or whatever. So.
That's right. I agree. But yeah, was there anyone else that wasn't addressed here? I think that's basically everyone, right?
We didn't see Sansa either, right?
Yes, I think that's right.
Sansa and Shay, so...
And what a big loss that was.
I mean, I cried. Or the Tyrells. Or Joffrey.
Right. No, that's right. That's right. So that was not there. Okay. Well, let's take a minute to thank all the people that made this podcast episode possible, Joanna.
We're calling this segment Joanna and Dave Butcher Generous People's Names.
But before we get to that segment, we got to thank... Okay. So when we did launch a Kickstarter for Cast of Kings, we had a bunch of sponsorship slots that if you paid a certain amount, you could sponsor an episode and that we would talk about what it is you do. And today, we got to talk about Roger from New Bedford, Massachusetts, and his website, rand247.com. That is rand247.com, rand247.com. And not really much to do here except to read, like, he's an artist, and I'm just going to read his description here. What I am is a Boston-based freelance illustrator, a drawer and a tracer both. I spend most of my time sketching focused on concept art and designing of licensed characters, costumes, vehicles, environments, icons, comp storyboards, and so on. My style has been described as fun, impactful, high energy, and graphic with a somewhat comic book sensibility. That would probably explain why most of the work that I've drawn over the years has been on Marvel Comics and Star Wars properties. I'm super fortunate to have some wonderful clients like Hasbro, Mattel, Disney Licensing, and Lucasfilm, to name a few. I've done most of my illustration work for packaging on tons of toy and game projects, plus loads of advertising art for agencies all around the country. So I know there's people out there right now that are thinking to themselves, man, I could really use a freelance illustrator. Couldn't you, Joanna Robinson?
I surely could.
All of us could at all times. I mean, there's very few people who don't need a freelance illustrator. If you have a website, if you have a blog, if you need toys illustrated for some reason, you know, rand247.com is the place you want to go. rand247.com.
And yeah, Dave and I both went over there. We were really impressed with the art today. We looked at it. And I want to say that branding, like, you cannot underestimate the impact that some really good art can have on your branding. So if you're looking to brand something, I would check out rand247.
Yeah, don't just, you know, type some Helvetica font on some image like I do most of the time. You got to choose you got to do it right, man. You got to come correct, as they say. And there's no better way to come correct than by hiring an incredibly talented freelance illustrator like Roger from New Bedford, Massachusetts. My old stomping grounds at rand247.com. That's rand247.com. And we thank Roger very much for his support of the Cast of Kings podcast. In addition to Robert's very generous contribution, there were also other people who made slightly smaller but still incredibly generous contributions. And we have promised to read their names on the show. So we've got to thank all these people who helped donate and make the Cast of Kings possible. They include John Hoyer. Let me just make clear also that a lot of these people included pronunciation guides because I asked for them. And even with the pronunciation guides, sometimes these names are still challenging to pronounce. So I may read some of the stuff that they write in their pronunciation guide during this segment. But John Hoyer, it's like lawyer but more awesome. Drew Baldwin, this gentleman here wrote, Rob G. from Chicago will suffice. So Rob G. from Chicago will suffice. Mark Pizzula, Dan Moran, Henrik Strand, Greg S. from Seattle, Justin D., John Cassell, Michael Nasser, Bastian Blank, Justin Camps, Adrian Lilly, Chris Lorenz, and Adam Rosalski. Thank you guys so much for your donations to the Cast of Kings podcast. Joanna Robinson, you have some names to thank as well?
I do. I want to thank Bianca, David Seuss, Jay Yee, Neil Joshi, Joe Shannon, Dan Wynn, Oliver Eichhorn from Germany, Ola Christian Storensen, and he said, just read it any way you want. Butchering of names is just charming. So Ola, I hope I did that right. Ben Hobden, Konstantinos Simeonidis. Simeonidis. I really think Dave gives me the really hard one.
Yes.
And then Janos Hildimond. Hildimond. Janos gave us like an audio pronunciation, and I'm still sure that I mispronounced it. Anders Tancred Holm and Shane Austin. So thank you guys, and I apologize for butchering your names in any way.
Thank you. You guys are awesome.
And, really, really sweet. Thank you for your donations.
Yes. All right. Let's move on, Joanna Robinson, into the rest of this episode. So what is going on beyond the wall? What's going on with the Night's Watch this week? First, we see what's going on with the wildlings, correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there's this kind of amazing shot where you see Mance Rayder walk upon this thing, and then it's like, picture this scene from The Godfather, except times 100 and in snow. And that's basically what you have here, with all these horse parts littered all over the place in this crop circle-like pattern.
And he said, ever the artist. So I don't know what that means. Like, I guess the others are known for being decorative in their death.
Well, I think they are. I mean, we've seen them.
What have we seen before that's indicative of that?
Well, just the opening episode, I guess.
But they didn't, like, make a mandala or a crop circle.
They didn't make a dream catcher out of it. You're right.
I mean, I want that deleted scene of them, like, placing the horse heads. Like, no, a little to the left.
Yeah, a little to the left.
That's good.
Don't mess it up. Don't mess it up. We need to have maximum impact when someone happens upon this. So these were Night's Watch people, or Night's Watch resources, right?
Right.
That were destroyed. Did we know any of the – because the Night's Watch people that we know, we see later on in this episode, right? So all those people are still alive. So did we know any of the people that died in this massive attack?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there were any of the – but there were 300 men to begin with.
Right.
And now it's like a raggle-taggle band of 20 or something like that. So – but what's most stunning in that scene is that, you know – Orel, who we met last week, who's got the hawk that he can send out, the warg that we met last week, who can see things. You know, Mance Rayder says to him, like, I thought you said there were dead crows here. Like, basically, I thought you said you saw dead men. And he's like, I did. Which means, of course, that they've been reanimated and they're zombie crows now.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
That was good times.
That was pretty chilling.
Yeah.
And then Mance instructs Tormund and Orel and John and Ygritte, I guess, to go take the wall, that, you know, they're supposed to break into the wall basically so that they can let him and his troops in.
Right. And it wasn't clear to me, they're going to Mance is going to light a fire when they want, when he is ready to take the wall. Is that right? Or, like, will they already have penetrated the wall? Are they supposed to have already penetrated the wall by that point?
Basically, they're supposed to break into the wall, you know, like, be the inside job. The men on the inside, they're supposed to break into the wall, and so that when Mance is ready to attack, they can just let him in.
I see. And when he lights the fire, that's going to be
their
the signal.
Got it. Yeah.
Cool.
I guess. Yeah.
So then we catch up with the Night's Watch, and Craster's back to his old ways. Really, really fun stuff.
He is a charming host.
He's really charming. I mean, at least he let them in at all, really.
Basically Martha Stewart, this guy.
But you got to imagine that the last interaction they had was not good, right? Because Jon Snow basically ruined everything. So I'm impressed that he let them in at all. And then Sam gets made fun of, leaves, and in a remarkably fortuitous situation, walks in on the birth of Gilly's son, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so multiple levels of crazy stuff going on here. First of all,
well, you could like hear her giving birth in the background all through that scene where they're right. where he's being called Piggy and all that sort of stuff. So.
Right, and then it just so happens that they're there when she's giving birth, and right. then also that it's a son, so that means that bad things are going to. Crasher's not going to want to keep that around,
right?
So bad things happening all around. I mean. You know, this is kind of one of those coincidences that seems like too convenient for a show to have something like this happen.
Right, that they show up right when Gilly's
right when this crucial thing is happening.
Yeah,
is when they're there. So felt a little bit contrived, but whatever. This, you know, we've complained about worse situations in the show before, so I'm not even gonna expend my energy complaining about that. Just I will mention it though. So
I won't let it slip past.
Yeah, I'm not gonna let it slip
past. But I'm not gonna dwell.
That's right. What did you think of it?
It was fine. I mean, I think they did a good job with Craster's keep like making it feel so claustrophobic and terrible, and the tensions are so high, and it was just, you know, like that scene made my skin crawl. And you're kind of sympathetic. You're with Sam. You want to like get the fuck out of there because it's just like a powder keg, man. So
yeah,
I thought it was good.
So then later on in the episode, we venture to Astapor, where Daenerys is still deciding whether or not to buy the army of the Unsullied. And
I can't remember last week if we – or the first episode of the season if we saw that giant harpy statue that's in the opening credits.
Yeah, it's in the opening credits. I do not think we saw it in the
What did you think of it?
It looked pretty ostentatious and probably fake, right? Like they did not. I don't think they actually built that or found right. a place that looked like it. So it looked all right.
You think they didn't stumble upon a giant harpy statue in the desert?
So. And they're just like, let's make it just like this. I mean, to be fair, Joanna, a lot of the stuff that you see on the show, I'm guessing at least some of it is stuff they found in real life.
That's true.
So,
but.
Yeah, not something that distinctive. So what is the Walk of Punishment, Joanna? Can you explain this to us?
You know, I don't believe it's really gone into in the book. So, you know, it's just it is what it seems, which is, you know, a place that they put slaves who have misbehaved in some way. But I think what it meant to show us is that, you know, the slave refuses help. So it's like even in dire circumstances, they still have this weird loyalty
right.
to, you know, they've done something wrong. They deserve this punishment or what have you. So.
And the visual is incredible. Like, so one of the great things about the show, I haven't seen how the show is made, but I'm going to make a bet that they did not actually have that many people up on those crosses, right? They didn't even actually have that many crosses. That this was a seamless blending of CGI and real life practical, right? And that's some of the stuff that the show does best is making you not know if what you're looking at was actually really built and exists in the real world or if it's in a computer somewhere. And the show blends them seamlessly. And I thought they did a great job of that, showing you this spectacular image of all these people up on these crosses that you would never, ever see in any other show, you'd never, ever see in real life. It just looks amazing. This sort of monument to human misery that is these crosses. So, you know, Joanna, some tension going on here between Ser Barristan Selmy
And
Jorah, right? It's kind of like when you have a to his company when it comes to young queen, young Khaleesi, and old advisor. When you have two old advisors, it's like you already have an old advisor. You know, it's like that episode of Bizarro Seinfeld where they say, "We already have a George." You know, it's kind of like we already have a old advisor dude. We already have a Jorah, Ser Barristan. You can't really, you know, don't really fit in here. So
yeah, the tensions are pretty high. I agree. But we got some nice. They talked about Rhaegar, her brother. So we got some nice Targaryen history there. And but I liked her line where she says, you know, it's nice to hear that you fought with my brother, but he was not the last dragon. Like, they give Dany these, like, badass little catchphrase lines, and that was one of them, so.
I will take what is mine with fire and blood.
Right.
Essentially, yeah. And she does a fairly good job at it. She's growing into it, I think, quite well.
The actress?
Yeah, the actress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. I really like what they've done with her. I mean, we've only seen her twice, but it's like so much better than last season, isn't it?
You mean her plot line this season?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
and then just the general performance.
You mean her just dying in the desert was not compelling to you?
Where are my dragons?
Yeah. Saying "where are my dragons" like 50 times. Not only has she stopped saying "where are my dragons," she has become willing to part with one of them. What?
Question mark?
So they have this great conversation, and again, like the subtitle usage is masterful in these scenes, right? They intercut between like sometimes showing you the subtitles and sometimes not.
Right.
So it's a little confusing, but it's also like they know exactly what they're doing, like when to show you the subtitles and when not to. And I thought it was amazing yet again. And I kind of wanted to have this holy crap moment where Ser Jorah actually has been understanding the language this whole time and kind of like, you know, shows them up. Do you know what I mean? I was kind of hoping he would know and then like respond in that language and kind of they would be like, what?
And he'd be like, oh, damn, yeah. He's got Jorah Mormonted.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But that never happened, unfortunately. So she doesn't have enough gold for the Unsullied, and the guy kind of does this mathematical breakdown. Like, well, let's see, all the gold you have and the ships, that'll give you like a couple hundred Unsullied at most. But then she's willing to part with a dragon for all of the Unsullied ever. I thought there was an interesting point there about the ones that are still in training.
Right.
And they said, oh, we can't have those get out because those will make us look bad. But she said she still wanted those anyway, correct?
To like pick up the swords when right. the older ones die. Yeah,
right, exactly.
She wants them all.
They are really concerned with the image of the Unsullied. They have a really good brand management.
They don't want to damage their brand.
Yeah,
but
that's
basically,
right.
I mean, what it ties into is that Dany not only wants soldiers, but she wants to give these slaves a better situation. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen that. Yeah, we've seen that over the past two episodes that we've seen her in, is like how much she hates this slave system. And so, and it should be noted that Missandei, who is the translator, she's like 12 in the book or 10. She's 10 in the books. So, it's this aging up thing that we've seen over and over again, that in this instance, I think gives us something nice to look at, is my guess why she's older.
Khaleesi, a dragon is worth more than any army.
Aegon Targaryen proved that.
You're both here to advise me. I value your advice, but if you ever question me in front of strangers again, you'll be advising someone else. Is that understood? Do you have a name?
This one's name is Missandei, Your Grace.
Do you have a family, a mother and a father you'd return to if you had the choice?
No, Your Grace. No family living.
You belong to me now. It is your duty to tell me the truth.
Yes, Your Grace, lying is a great offence. Many of those on the Walk of Punishment were taken there for less.
I offered water to one of the slaves dying on the Walk of Punishment. Do you know what he said to me? Let me die.
There are no masters in the grave, Your Grace.
Is it true what Master Krasnus told me about the Unsullied, about their obedience?
All questions have been taken from them. They obey, that is all. Once they are yours, they are yours. They will fall on their swords if you command it.
And what about you? You know that I'm taking you to war. You may go hungry. You may fall sick. You may be killed.
Valar Morghulis.
Yes. All men must die. But we are not men.
What's pretty great is that here's a totally minor character, like the translator character, who you don't really develop that much of a... There's not that much of an explanation of what her life is like up to this point.
Right.
But you still know enough to know that she's probably miserable.
You know what I mean?
And the fact that you don't
think working for Master Krasnus is a dream? You don't think he's just like a dream employer and probably gives her lots of vacation?
Yeah, and bonuses and everything like that.
It
sounds like a sweet gig. But I mean, that's kind of cool, is that obviously Dany was, you know, herself kind of enslaved, right?
Exactly.
And so it's very sympathetic.
She was sold by her brother to the Dothraki. So, yeah.
So she has a lot of sympathy for that type of situation, and that she freed her. I thought that was nice. That was a nice little gesture.
Yeah.
And the way she did it, too. She kind of like, and I'm taking her, too.
Right.
You know, as a gift, as a nice gesture.
Yeah.
And of course, what is he going to say? Now, what is interesting to me is Jorah and Barristan, who are both chastised for this afterwards, questioned her judgment about the dragons, right?
Right.
Should she have given up these dragons for these dudes? In their opinion, that was a bad move.
Right. That was like a Catelyn Stark move right there.
Oh. She really catted that situation, as
she,
it were.
She britted that situation.
She britted that. and yeah, so I'm kind of curious about, I know you probably know ultimately whether this gamble ends up paying off, but I am curious as to whether or not, let me just describe to you my thought process. I actually thought she was totally reasonable, right? Because she has these, is it three dragons, right?
Three, yeah.
She has three dragons, and they are priceless in their value because no one else in the entire world has them, right?
Right.
So she has these dragons, and they're amazing, and no one else has them. And so one should be willing to pay the Westeros equivalent of millions upon millions upon millions of dollars for billions of dollars for these dragons. Which is ultimately what I think, you know, this Army of the Unsullied ends up being. It ends up being a massive investment. I mean, I think, in my opinion, Dany's just being a smart businesswoman. She's just saying, look, I have these dragons. They're of immeasurable value, but really, like, I really need two of them working in concert for me to achieve my goals, right? I really need both the dragon, both the dragons and this army to back me up, because just the dragons alone, it's probably not going to be sufficient. Even if you have dragons terrorizing everything, you need people to kind of who's going to be patrolling the streets at night, you know? Who's going to be guarding the palace walls, right? Like, you can't, three dragons can't do everything. So making this trade for her is like, I can still have two of my dragons, although the smaller ones, and I can have this army of 8,000 who are like incredible and will do anything for me. And so for her, if she had traded two dragons, okay, that would have been if she traded two or three dragons, different scenario. But one dragon, she gets to keep two dragons and have this huge army of dudes. Seems like a fair trade to me. So that's my reasoning. I know you can't comment on it, Joanna.
Yeah, no, I won't comment too much at all in any spoiler way, but I promise, I swear.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Usually when someone says that, Joanna.
You know, they're just about to spoil something. but the one thing I'll say is she said, I think she said it in the show, but she definitely says it in the book, is like, you know, Barristan and Jorah are like, in a year, your dragons will be fully grown. And she's basically like, I can't wait. I need an army now. You know, I can't wait for my dragons to be grown and at their full power. I need an army now. So there's that calculation in her head.
Why do you think there is that urgency?
She wants her throne.
She's just like, I want it now.
She wants, yeah, she's very Baruch Assault about it. And then the other thing is, the other thing that you're not considering, I think, is how much she considers these her children. How it's not just a calculated like business Khaleesi move. It's like she called herself the mother of dragons. She'll never be able to have children because of what that witch woman did to her. So these are the closest she will ever have to children. So she basically gave up one of her children for an army. So, you know, in that way, I think it has a bigger emotional piece to it that you know.
I don't think that really comes across in the show, though.
I agree.
Like, she did it very coldly. She wasn't like, "Ooh, I got to think about this," and like, right. She didn't have this conversation with the dragons. Like, are you ready to live in, you know, Astapor?
Right?
Are you going to be okay, little one?
You know, like, you don't eat your nipples, do you?
Yeah, no? You know what I mean. Like, there's no conversation. There's no thought about it. She's just okay, done. Just done.
I feel like that was her plan going in. It's like, right. She doesn't say it in the negotiation moment, but it's something that she thought about. Anyway,
but also,
I agree that emotional bit does not come through in the show. I agree.
Right. And but what was interesting was she didn't want to show any weakness. Right.
Right.
So she's learning. And she chastised Barristan and Jorah for questioning her.
Yeah.
So, by the way, let me rewind a little bit and clarify something that we talked about in the past. But in this week's episode, they finally clarified the whole why aren't there more smoke babies?
Yes.
Melisandre says, you know, you don't have the pyre. You don't have the power to do it. Again, not really something that is conveyed well in the show, right? Like, it's not like Stannis was weak after the smoke baby was born. Do you know what I mean?
Right, so, and this is what we talked about earlier, where you were like, Stephen Delane looks so haggard anyway. There would be no way.
Yeah.
To show.
Yeah. So,
hello, his fires are burning.
That's right. So I just wanted to point that out that, yeah, we did talk about that on the podcast and it was clarified in the show, but a little clumsily, I thought, and not maybe they're going to reveal more as time goes on, but it wasn't explained very well. So
yeah, and I wanted to say one more thing about the Dani plotline.
Yes, sorry.
It's okay. Her exiting line, she's walking out with Missandei, and she goes, Missandei says, Valar Morghulis. And Dani says, yeah, all men must die, but we are not men. And which was such like an Eowyn from Lord of the Rings line, not in the book. So they give her these catchphrases sometimes that are just maybe like a little... a little too much.
A little too feministy for your tastes.
Yeah, I don't like feminism.
That's right.
It was a little Tolkien-y. So that's, I thought they were ripping off Tolkien there.
That is what Valar Morghulis means. We've learned that this week then, right?
I think we already knew that, but all men must die. Yeah. Then Valar Dwaris, all men must serve. Gotcha. Are the two sort of call and response catchphrases.
Well, speaking of feminism, Joanna.
It's my favorite part of the show, guys.
It's our favorite part of the show where we evaluate how integral to the plot the nudity of this episode was. Now, there was no gratuitous nudity in last week's episode of Game of Thrones.
No.
And so, yeah, what is going on there? What is going on?
They were like, we need to make up for it.
We need to make up for it this week. So they want to reward... So Roz, who is now full on, right, handling Baelish's affairs.
Right. We got a nice gratuitous, down tunic shot of Roz, fetching the ledgers out.
Right.
And that was great.
And I thought it was good that – so someone actually emailed to point this out about how Tywin in, a couple weeks ago was referring to Tyrion having a whore in his bed. That was actually – he thought that was actually Roz and not Shay.
Right.
Because of what Cersei's detective work was able to put together. And I like that they actually acknowledge that in this episode, right? They actually kind of acknowledge that plot point that, oh, yeah, you kind of had one of my horrors brutally beaten, and I'm still unhappy about that.
No, but I thought it was more like you saved her from being killed. Thank you for that. I thought Baelish said he owed him for that.
Interesting. Okay.
I don't know.
Well.
But then Baelish also got off a lot of short jokes, which was pretty awesome. Yeah. So.
They just kind of have this conversation about what's going on with the kingdom, and then they decide to reward Podrick for saving Tyrion's life. What was the necessity of this scene, Joanna? That's my question, right? Let me be careful in the way I ask this question.
Not in the book.
The Podrick scene was not in the book?
No.
At all?
No. Pod is 12 in the book, so no. It's not in the book.
Wow. Okay.
Which is fine. I mean, that's fine. Whatever.
But can we at least acknowledge that the sequence was really well done?
It was. It was adorable.
The way that he introduced all of the prostitutes and the kind of reveal of each one.
It was like an old MGM musical. But let me... this is my thought on it. It's not that it bothers me as a lady and a feminist, but just let's call it what we want to call it. Let's not call it... integral to the plot, or it's all right, we would like to show some naked ladies. We've come up with a cute way to do it with Pod, and I thought it was a pretty cute little scenario that they did. And then they had that whole post-game wrap up with Bronn and Tyrion,
was admittedly very amusing.
I mean, it was adorable.
Yes.
It was, but let's just call a spade and say that the reason they have it is to show some nudity. Because it's Game of Thrones, Does that make sense?
It kind of makes sense. I mean,
It bothered me less than that shot from the first episode. It didn't really bother me at all. I just it's fine as long as we all acknowledge that there's gratuitous TNA in the show.
I think people aren't acknowledging it. I think the argument that could be made against it is that it lessens the show. It lessens the show when you're off on these tangents to just show nudity and... often in a fairly gratuitous fashion, in a way that doesn't integrate well into any of the that's not integral to the main plot lines going on in the story. I'm not saying that that this didn't make sense organically in the story. Obviously, Tyrion wants to reward Podrick for saving his life. That makes sense, right? But that it's unnecessary, and why have it? That being said, like you said, Joanna, it has kind of become part of the show itself, right? So there's a balance between to what extent is the nudity gratuitous and unnecessary and lessens the sort of serious dramatic standards of the show, and to what extent is it so baked into the show's identity that it is just part of the show that like that you're watching? Do you know what I mean?
Well, but it's also like we're not sitting down to watch Mad Men or Breaking Bad. We're watching Game of Thrones. So like there is some serious dramatic integrity to the show, but it's also fun. And so, you know, I don't mean to like – I'm not reversing my
position. Because those shows are not fun at all.
quite often. Well, no, I mean like –
you know what I mean? Like I don't agree with your argument is what I'm saying. I mean I think that like
– Yeah, okay. Breaking Bad has fun parts to it. But like it's – okay, let me think of something better. I don't know. We're not sitting down to like some sort of dramatic slog. We're sitting down to like a sword and sandal sort of fun epic. And yeah, it has some dramatic points to it. And I mean, does it degrade the integrity, the artistic integrity of the show to just have some TNA in it? It might, but yeah, there are worse things.
All right, you know what? If you don't have a problem with it, then I'm not gonna complain about it.
No, I mean, I think sometimes, like, I still stand by what I said last season about Osha getting out of a trap by getting naked instead of fighting. Like, that's not, I think that's uncool. But you know, inventing whole cloth this scene with some naked ladies, whatever, I don't know.
all right or not whole cloth, as it were, partial cloth. Boom.
There was that one. Did you get like I got worried for a second that we were going to see everything, because that one chick came out, she had some clothes on, the other ones didn't, and I was like, oh my god, what's about to happen? Oh, okay, it's slightly covered, that's fine. Anyway,
why did you get worried about that? Are you afraid?
I'm not afraid. I was just like, wow, are we going to go here? Is this going to happen right now? And then I was like, oh, no, it's not happening.
Well, Pod certainly went there. Boom! If you know what I'm saying.
I think you do.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Should we go to somewhere less sexy, like Theon's plotline?
Well, let's just make a point that that Tyrion is very worried about the finances of the kingdom.
I like how he had a little like Econ 101 lesson with Bronn.
King's Landing is in the same situation as the United States is with China in present day rate, basically, right?
Yeah.
We're borrowing money at an unsustainable rate.
Yes.
How do you like that topicality?
I like it.
Okay, so who knows if that's going to come to anything? I mean, the thing is, this show introduced financial matters in the first season as well, when Ned first got to King's Landing. And right. Like, who gave a like? Did that, was that really consequential at all? I don't feel like it was. Like, the only thing I feel like you really need to know is that the Lannisters have a crap ton of money in terms of finances. Do you know what I mean?
Right. And
no one cares basically about money in the show, is what I'm saying. Other than the fact that Lannisters have a lot of it. So I'm going to make that point, and we'll see how much this plot line evolves, but I don't have faith that this Braavos bank thing is going to be that consequential. We'll see.
Okay.
Jonah's like, all right, we'll see. We'll see how wrong you are, Dave, in the days to come. So then we finally got...
Dave, I've been thinking a lot about the Iron Bank of Braavos.
So we got more details of the Theon plotline this week. And I got to say, this is a pretty freaking awesome sequence, right? The way it was shot, the way Theon's acting in it, the gorgeous vistas that you're privy to as a result of the show.
I found myself wondering where they went, where they shot that, where he was like out on the mountainside at one point.
Out on the mountainside, and like, then into the forest, yeah. And like run and on the horseback. It was like really thrilling, very well done. And then the dude, so what was really disturbing is they were about to rape Theon.
Yes.
Apparently, that's like accepted sort of punishment in Westeros.
It was a pretty rapey episode, I have to say.
Yeah, really pretty traumatic, and I just felt so bad for Theon, because dude, Theon has, you know, despite all the terrible things that Theon has done, he's just not had a good time in terms.
Yeah, but
of life.
I think we keep forgetting that he had two rando boys killed, like two random little boys were killed.
Yeah, that's true, but that was only because he couldn't have his father's love, Joanna.
Only because he couldn't find the right boys.
Which justifies a whole host of things, in my opinion. But yeah, Theon just had a bad time. You know, he went home, was totally humiliated, then went and did all these terrible things in the name of his father, and then was brutally tortured, and then was about to be raped. And then this mysterious dude comes in and saves him. What did you think of the sequence, Joanna?
I'm not going to talk too much about it. But
can
I thought
you,
it was,
can you say that you liked it?
I did like it. I loved it. It was beautifully shot. The bit with the archery and the arrows was awesome.
Oh, yeah. When he shoots the arrow right 2 inches away from his face.
Yeah.
Unnecessary. Exactly. Unnecessary.
But yeah. Awesome. So, yeah, I thought that was really good. That's all I'm going to say.
All right, and finally, a little bit more resolution to the Jaime and Brienne storyline. Now, something we didn't mention about the Jaime and Brienne storyline last week was that random guy that Jaime said, "Dude, you should totally kill that guy," ended up actually being leading to their undoing.
Right. So it was Brienne's honor got them captured.
Basically. Not even her honor. I think her mercy.
Her having any sort of human emotion.
Yeah, human decency.
Yeah.
Her human decency led to her undoing. And so they have this conversation in the woods where Jaime is just just let them have their way. And Brienne's like, "Would you?" And he's like, "Well, fortunately, I don't need to entertain that question," right? And then they, from knowing Brienne's character, she will not go quietly into that good night. And no. That is good for her. And there's this really touching scene where Jaime uses what little power he has to persuade the gentleman in charge. What's his name again?
Locke.
He persuades Locke to not have Brienne brutally raped.
You know who she is, don't you? Some big dumb bitch from who cares where. The Bean was a woman that big.
She's Brienne of Tarth. Her father's Lord Selwyn Tarth. Heard of Tarth? They call it the Sapphire Isle. You know why? Every sapphire in Westeros was mined on Tarth. Sapphires are gemstones, the blue ones.
I know what they are.
Lord Selwyn would pay his daughter's weight in sapphires if she's returned to him. But only if she's alive, her honor unbesmirched.
Bring her back here!
That is a crucial scene right there, because it kind of shows that Jaime has gained enough respect for Brienne that he's willing to do anything on her behalf. His captor. Anytime you have someone who's like a situation with a captor and a captive, and the captive does something to help the captor, I always find that really moving.
Yeah.
You know, a movie that...
A little Stockholm Syndrome going on.
Yeah. a movie it reminded me of is actually a really brilliant film by directed by Tommy Lee Jones called The Three Barrels of Melquiades Estrada.
Yeah.
Which is similar in the sense that it kind of has the whole movie is this guy who's kind of being held captive by this other guy, right? Like the whole time. And being forced to do all these things. So it really reminded me of that moment in that movie. I'm not going to say what it is, but there is a similar moment, and I was equally moved by both moments. So what did you make of the scene, Joanna?
Yeah, I thought it was great. You know, they're cleaving pretty close to the book with the Jaime and Brienne stuff, and it's paying off, I think, in terms of there's nothing that needs improving. His whole Sapphire Isle lie and all of that. I mean, I love those two characters. I mean, this is one of my favorite plot lines that we're seeing in every time they show them. I mean, even when they were tied back to back on the horse and that she was sort of taunting him for being not very as good as his reputation in sword fighting. I mean, both of them are so perfect for the roles and they're doing such a good job. So,
yeah. But then Jaime overreaches a little bit, as it were.
Right.
And
he won't be reaching anymore.
Oh, zing. Anyway, He overreaches and kind of assumes too much about his standing. He entered the situation with the wrong assumption, or rather he did not assume what he should have, which is that he is totally, utterly hated by everyone.
Right.
And thought he could talk his way out of the situation. Because, I mean, he talked his way out of the Brienne situation.
Right.
So why couldn't he talk himself out of the situation?
Right.
And just this really tense scene where you don't know what's going to happen, and like Locke is pressing this blade into Jamie's eye. You don't know if he's going to take out his eye. And then for a second, you think maybe Jamie's out of the woods in terms of danger, but then they chop off his hand. And they took off his sword hand too, man. And it is a shocking moment in Game of Thrones history, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it kind of you kind of experience that scene through Jamie's eyes because you don't even really realize exactly what has happened at first, right? Like for me, I was like, okay, he put it down. Did it go through his hand? And there was kind of a second of realization,
right?
And you really experience the full horror of that sequence. This episode, I think, was directed by David Benioff, right? Who?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, who is one of the creators of the show?
Yeah,
hasn't done as much directorial work as some of the other directors who have worked on Game of Thrones. But I thought did a pretty great job here.
Yeah.
And certainly that sequence. Yeah, it looks like this was the only episode this season that he directed, Walk of Punishment. So really great stuff.
And I think people have been complaining or at least remarking that it feels like the first couple episodes was a lot of play setting, table setting, whatever, getting people into place.
Well, by people, you mean me, right?
Well, no, not just you, but like also you, but, you know, other people. And I think now what we're going to see is this is, you know, when action starts happening. So a major character just lost his hand. It's a big fucking deal.
That is,
and yeah, you know,
especially a major character who is like well known as a warrior.
Yeah. As a sword fighter. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, and is, you know, for being handsome and dashing and whatever. And he is for the rest of his life going to be only have one hand,
right?
You know, and he's like, he is the golden child of his family as opposed to his crippled brother. And now he's going to, you know, have no hand. And, I don't know. So anyway, you can't really say that things aren't happening because things are starting to happen. So
yeah, and there's like smash cut to black, and then this song plays, which I think was a song that Locke's men were singing earlier in the episode, right?
Yes, exactly.
So this show has done this before, where like Reigns of Castamere, they were singing during the episode, and then they had the national perform it in the credits. In this instance, it was, what was the song called, Joanna?
The Bear and the Maiden Fair.
The Bear and the Maiden Fair, performed by, do you know who?
The Hold Steady.
Right, which is a far different style song than the other one.
Really, so the Reigns of Castamere is like a war song, and this is supposed to be like a rousing, fun drinking song that you sing in the tavern when you're super drunk.
Got it.
And it was actually – it's actually integral to the plot. It's supposed to come when the Queen of Thorns, Lady Olenna, is talking to Sansa in the garden there. So she's supposed to have like a jester who's singing the song really loudly so that no one will eavesdrop on them. And so they put it here instead, but I loved it. I thought it worked really well in the episode, and I loved hearing it over the credits. I thought the Hold Steady did a good job with it. So,
yeah, I mean, when you exit out on such a spectacular, note, you really don't have that many options for what will sound good afterwards, right?
Right.
And so you already shocked us with this scene. Why not be equally shocking with this really bombastic song as well? And I thought it was really well done. But the whole thing made me very uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? Like seeing the arm get chopped off and then like me dealing with the horror and then just being hit again with this really loud song.
With a rousing song.
Yeah, that's like not at all in tone with, you know, what had just come before it.
Sure, yeah.
Because what was before, it was very much like a horror scene, right? From a horror movie. And then hearing this loud punk rock song, it really effective, but very discomforting for me. So, and my question for you, Joanna, is like in the books, so he gets his hand chopped off and then like smash cut to black, right? Does like a chapter end with him getting his hand cut off?
Yeah, actually, oh my God, can I, is this so dorky? Can I read what happens?
Please.
Oh my gosh! You guys are gonna have story time.
Assuming
let me find the
spoil.
Page. It doesn't spoil anyway. Yeah. Okay. So he. So this is Jamie's narration. He says, "They mean to scare me." The fool hopped on Jamie's back, giggling as the Dothraki swaggered toward him. The goat wants me to piss my britches and beg his mercy, but he'll never have that pleasure. He was a Lannister of Casterly Rock, Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. No sellsword could make him scream. Sunlight ran silver along the edge of the Arak as it came shivering down, almost too fast to see, and Jamie screamed. And that's the end of the chapter. So you actually don't know if he's gonna live or whatever. But that's the and then yeah, and then you're
whoa, you spoiler for the book, Joanna.
But I love the way that's written. He's like, no one will make me scream, and then the knife, and then he screams, you know, right, and you don't right. know what's happened. It's very effective storytelling.
Interesting,
so.
Interesting. Very yeah. cool.
Story time, you guys. That will probably never happen again.
All right. So that's our review of this episode, Walk of Punishment. Any closing thoughts, Joanna? And then we're going to get to some emails. I thought it was a good episode. Solid episode. Really good episode of Game of Thrones. Just, yeah overall, very good.
Fantastic. So.
Okay. Got some emails here. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. This guy writes in, Jamie from Perth, Western Australia, writes in, on Dave's remarks that Sam seems to be a useless character, I would like to challenge this by saying Sam is not as physically strong, brave, or ruthless as other members of the Night's Watch, but he's intelligent, inquisitive, and loyal, which are endearing to me. Him collapsing to the ground this episode is a natural reaction after experiencing something highly traumatic like seeing the White Walkers, as well as fatigue and being upset his friends left him to die. Also, I don't think anyone should take the side of a vicious, cruel rapist like Rast, the guy taunting Sam on anything, but that's just me. In my defense, he is not identified as a rapist in the show, really, right, to my knowledge.
He might, like, I don't know if, like, the conversations that they had in the barn, remember when, like, Tyrion comes in and right. sort of tells and all the guys, they might have mentioned it there, but I don't
yeah,
think
like,
they
that guy's
a huge
a rapist.
Deal with it.
Yeah,
yeah,
that guy's a rapist or that guy did this, yeah. I think right. they might have mentioned it, you're right. But
it wasn't like every episode we've been like, Rast the rapist, and you're like, I'm on Rast the rapist side.
And let me just say also that the show really downplays Rast's like negative. I'm sorry, it downplays both Rast's negative qualities as well as Sam's positive qualities.
Right? Yeah, I don't know. I think Rast is still pretty despicable, but I will agree that they are not doing a good job of showing Sam's worth in terms of another listener or. I think it was actually someone who was listening to us do the live broadcast over on YouTube last week said something about how Sam is the map reader. And that's not something that I brought up. But yeah, Sam has the maps and they don't show that at all. But he's the one who like tells them where they're going. He is important. He is smart. They're not doing a good job of showing that.
No,
I agree.
No, they're not. So to the TV viewer like me, it's just like this totally useless character who's becoming even more useless. And, you know.
And there's something that they're leaving out entirely. That's all I'll say about that. I don't know why they're doing it, but they just left it out entirely. And
you could almost say they're leaving it out entirely.
Oh, Sam. Oh, God.
A delightful play on words, Joanna.
Anyway, I don't know if they're going to do it later, so I won't talk about it. But I feel like they're doing this.
So you're wrong, Jamie. I'm right about about Sam's uselessness on the show. That's all I'm saying. Okay, let's move on to Ian from Atlanta, Georgia, who writes in, I disagree with Joanna's comment that the inn that was shown last episode, it was only the same set as the inn where Catelyn Stark took Tyrion as hostage. In the book series, there really is a singular inn at what's called the Crossroads that is the site of many passages between different characters, some of whom have never even met. In the books, the inn seems to represent the small folk within Westeros and how they are affected by the wars and intrigues of the people we think of as the main characters. It is a location of many pivotal moments and yet is still just an inn, trying to keep its doors open in order to make an honest living in the midst of turmoil. I think the show's creators intended for it to be the same inn to bring those same themes into the TV show, which made me very happy to see. So, Joanna, how do you defend against this impugning of your honor, really, that's going on?
What I'm saying is, okay, let's just be clear. There's not, like, one inn in the books. But they did make it clear this week that because Arya goes up to the Hound. She's like, do you remember what happened last time we were here? And what she's referencing is when he killed the butcher's boy, who was her friend. And so that is supposed to be the same inn from season one. So, you know, the Inn of the Crossroads is an important, cool aspect of the story and of the world. And the TV creators may very well intend for it all to be one inn. But I am going to say that there isn't just one inn in the book ever that they use. So.
Oh, snap.
What? I was agreeing and defending myself at the same time. So I think I'm wrong in this instance. But I think anyway, that's all I'll say.
All right.
It's never happened before, and it'll never happen again.
That's right. That's right. Duncan from slashfilm.com writes in on our comment about River Run. Just a quick note on River Run. It doesn't appear in season one, but it is talked about quite a bit. In response to Tyrion's kidnapping, Lord Tywin sends Jaime to besiege the castle, as it is the seat of Catelyn's father. And when Rob captures Jaime and smashes his host in episode 9, he has lifted the siege of Riverrun. What does that mean, smashes his host?
A host is like the warriors.
Oh, okay.
A host of warriors.
He has lifted the siege of Riverrun and wed the Tullys and the other Riverlords to his cause. So just wanted to thank you, Duncan, for just pointing out that the Riverrun was mentioned a bunch of times and in what context that was mentioned, and it didn't really appear in the show until this episode. So,
and the thing that we should mention about Riverrun, at least the dock scene, I think they did such a good job with the look of it. You know, we've got a lot of the Stark wolf imagery and the Lannister lion imagery. The Tully, House Tully, it's a fish, which is not as cool, obviously, but they're river folk, so it's a fish. But the beautiful, like, fish carvings that they had on the docks was really nice. And then the Tully men, Brynden and Edmure, are wearing, like, fish scale armor, which I thought looked really cool. So I thought they did a really good job design-wise with the River Run set. So.
Very cool. All right, Jonah Robinson, anything else you want to cover this week?
Yeah, I had an email from Chuck from Florida, and he asked me, as a book reader, and I actually work in a bookstore, if I had any recommendations for people who really liked the Game of Thrones series. And so I might do like a regular weekly, just quick rec. And so this week I'm going to recommend The Amber Chronicles by Roger Zelazny. And I'm going to quote one George R.R. Martin about it. He says of Roger Zelazny, "A storyteller without peer, he created worlds as colorful and exotic and memorable as any your genre, as any our genre has ever seen." And so it's got a lot of the jockeying for political intrigue sort of stuff that makes Game of Thrones so interesting. So The Amber Chronicles, it's 10 books, long completed, so you don't have to wait for a new book to come out. So that would be my recommendation this week. Check out.
You know, there's also one email I want to read, Joanna, just for funsies.
Is it about me being wrong again?
No, it's not. It's not. Here we go. This email comes in from Umberto Pena from Tijuana, Mexico. And he says here, "I love the way you manage to portray the different points of view of people who watch the show and those who have read the book. I especially enjoy the clumsy way in which Dave tries to interpret each episode and Joanna subtly nags him. Dave, please don't take this the wrong way, but it's like watching a guy who awkwardly reads a PowerPoint presentation slide before he tries to bullshit his way around the subject versus the girl who actually studied. I'm exactly like Dave in that way, and I always will be. But it is nice seeing it and hearing it in someone else. I also wanted to ask, what is exactly the dynamic of your relationship? I've always thought that you guys were just friends, but in this last episode, I sensed some sort of weird X vibe. You don't really have to answer that if you don't want to, and I will totally understand if you don't, but, you know, it's just something I sort of wish to know. P.S. Joanna, will you marry me? I'm a nice guy." So, Joanna, you still there?
Yeah, I'm
okay.
Here.
Okay, I was like, did she flee the podcast? It's just totally silent. So, Joanna, the question about marrying you, you're going to have to answer that yourself.
Oh, I will email Umberto directly.
Okay, you're going
to
resolve
email.
That directly. And as for the dynamic of the relationship between us, I think it's better if people don't know what it is, right? I think it's more enjoyable for the listeners if they don't know. I will say this much. Joanna and I have never met in person. And
it's
we
true.
Can just leave it at that.
It's true.
Is there anything else you care to comment on, Joanna?
We fight like exes, so I can see that.
All right. I think that's going to wrap us up for today. John Robinson, you want to tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Every day on Podiba.com. You can follow me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob. And this week I was a guest on the Slash Filmcast with one Dave Chen and Devinda Hardawar. And that was quite fun, so you can check that out.
Yeah, and we've actually been like recording for the last 3.5 hours.
Yeah, this is
so it's been quite a morning. You can find me at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen SKY and DaveChen.net. And find all of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also find me, email us, let us know what you think of the podcast and of what you think we got wrong at acastofkings@gmail.com. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks to slashfilm.com for making this podcast possible. We'll see you guys next week.